I know that several people in this assembly have no problem at all with spending some time alone. Is that a good thing? I mean, it's not that we introverts want to become hermits and go live in the deep woods of Canada in some kind of a log cabin somewhere, although occasionally I've thought about that. But, you know, generally that's not what we want to do. We're really not like Elijah and want to go live somewhere by ourselves in a cave. At least I'm not like that, at least not all the time. But at the same time, many of us here, I know, are just fine being alone with a project or a good book or just a walk alone in the woods is really very refreshing. And we kind of like that, right? Now, here's a very important question for introverts. Is it possible for us to completely fulfill the plan and the will of God by being alone? And the answer to that is very simply no. God didn't make us that way. You know, God created all things, and He pronounced all things good. And that included the creation of Adam, who at that time was alone. Was Adam an introvert? That's a good question for some of you to debate. Or did Adam find fellowship with the animals? Did he talk to the animals? You know, it really does appear that in the order of God's creation, Adam was alone with the animals for quite some time while he was naming all of them. But we also know from God's own testimony that it was not good for Adam to be alone without a suitable helper. The animals were not suitable helpers. You know, I know you love your pets, but the relationship there is limited by nature of you and the animal. So, we know also that God made us, made man, made Adam, in His image, part of which is to be a social creature, to be communicative, to be able to interact with other beings. Well, God made us in His image. Of course we would be that way. Because from the very beginning, do you realize you have the three persons of the Trinity, God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, who are talking to each other. And what did they say? Let us make man in our image. They're communicating. Now, I know it's a little bit hard for us to grasp that whole concept. And so we shouldn't be surprised also to find that after God has created Adam and his helper Eve, that God is found walking with them, communicating with them in the garden. Why? Well, He's communicative. And so while being alone a little bit can be a good thing for us therapeutically, in balance, being an isolationist is not good. And God does not recommend that to us. And Solomon figured that out. He learned that in his great experiment with life, that being an isolationist brings certain consequences. Ultimately, it's really not the best. In fact, it will actually contribute to the vanity, the worthlessness of life. Again, this part of the experiment clearly points us to this reality. God must be an integral part of our life, an integral part of our relationship. In fact, it is because God lends meaning and purpose to life. In fact, God gives us that truth even in this text, in spite of the fact you won't find the name God mentioned in chapter 4. But the overall truth of the book stands. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth before you get to be an old geezer like Whitcomb. Something like that. That's a paraphrase. This is our purpose. To know God. To know His commandments. Keep His commandments and live for His glory. And that pervades even chapter 4 where we find this very, very important principle. What do we do when there is no one to comfort? And that happens sometimes. Sometimes there's oppression. And that's what helps us understand this vanity of life. The preacher discovered this in his experiment. And we can't possibly deny this any more than Solomon would. Look what he wrote in chapter 4, verse 1. Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. Now, I don't know if you realize this. When we just read verse 1, as we finish verse 1 in a little bit, you'll see the word oppression, oppressed, oppressors. It's pretty obvious that Solomon is aware that oppression is a real problem in his culture, in his life. And you know, even from the English meaning of the word, it means to be abused, to treat disrespectfully, to cause suffering. Generally, it's talking about an authority who has no respect for a subordinate, and therefore runs roughshod over that subordinate, showing that person no respect, in fact, abusing that person on occasion. The preacher saw examples of that in his culture. We know from reading history what it must have looked like. In his day, class abuse was very common, the poor versus the rich. In his day, slavery was the norm. Do you think the slaves were not abused? Do you think there wasn't oppression for the wives and for the children who were considered in that culture to be nothing more than property? Possessions owned by the husband, the father? The wealthy cheated the poor, made more money off from the poor, became even wealthier. And as a result of that, you'll notice the preacher's experiment came to this conclusion. That's causing a lot of sorrow. That makes sense. We understand that. But here's the big question. Who comforts the oppressed? And this whole idea of comfort is not just to feel sorry for the suffering. I mean, we know that. We should. But the question is, are you demonstrating compassion? Who will comfort those who are oppressed? What are you doing to demonstrate compassion for the people who are oppressed? Well, the good news is, we live in a culture where nobody's oppressed. The bad news is, you're not paying attention. Of course we have oppression all around us. In fact, here's something very interesting. The modern socialists claim to have compassion for those who are oppressed. But compassion always requires some kind of demonstration. And the demonstration, almost without exception, is going to be sacrifice. So what about that sacrifice? The socialist today claims to be concerned about those people who are oppressed. But in reality, if you watch closely, what you will discover is that the socialists are actually using the oppressed people for their political gains. And not only are the oppressed people comforted, they are in worse shape after the socialists take office than before. And this is not something that we see just in America as something new. This is verified over and over and over through cultures for the last 50, 60 years. That's a fair description of what Solomon discovered in his day. The powerful are the ones who are oppressing the less powerful. Last part of verse 1. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. You see, the great problem in that culture was that people who rob society of justice are so powerful, nobody can do anything about it. They were in control. In fact, that's the scenario that often leads to attempts at rebellion or coups or overthrowing the government because the people finally take all they can take. They're oppressed all they care to be oppressed. And they don't care how powerful the government is. They're willing to make some kind of sacrifice to overthrow the powerful. That's been proven throughout history many times. Sometimes they're victorious. Sometimes those people who are oppressed are actually strong enough to overthrow the powers. Often they are not. The oppression continues, the question continues, who comforts the oppressed? That's the way it was in Solomon's day. In fact, Solomon himself made an interesting statement. We'll read it in a few weeks as we get to chapter 8, verse 4. The word of the king is supreme. Who may say to him, what are you doing? That's oppression. And it's still an issue in many cultures. It's not an issue in America, is it? And we don't suffer too much from oppression. I mean, there's not a lot of political oppression, is there? No, but even in the good old USA, there's such a thing as people being oppressed by their employers. Maybe you've heard of that. You ever hear of spiritual abuse from the power of pastors? That's way too common, way more common than it should be. One case is too common. judicial abuse, where powerful attorneys are able to go into courtroom, use the laws of the courtroom to twist the truth so the truth never comes out. And you can find case after case after case where innocent people are being oppressed because of that. Parental oppression of children, spousal oppression. Folks, it's real. I mean, what Solomon discovered is true even in so-called Christian America. In fact, history proves to us that the people who are powerful, as they become more powerful, have this tendency to oppress the people who are under them, and actually prove to us that oppression by the powerful is part and parcel with our sinful nature. Give any of us the opportunity to have unchecked power, and we will oppress people, almost without question. In fact, you can go all the way back in your Bible and history, and you might even ask this question. Did Cain actually oppress Abel? Well, he killed him. Well, that's pretty severe oppression. Who was more powerful? Well, that's the question. The record of history really indicates that the golden rule is simply this. He who has the gold makes the rules. And that's oppression. And so life can be very discouraging. You know, here in this environment we're living in, this kind of thing can be very, very discouraging for us. So the preacher comes to this incredible conclusion and think, boy, it's not that bad, is it? Is it really better if we were never even born? Are the dead really better off, verse 2? And I thought the dead who were already dead, more fortunate than the living who are alive. I'd call that extreme pessimism. Unless I was terribly oppressed, I might come to that conclusion. Is life really so bad? Even in the worst of circumstances, that we would conclude it's better to be dead? Well, some people actually believe this. Possibly you've heard of some of the laws called death with dignity that are passed in some states where you're actually allowed to come to this conclusion. You know, life's so rotten, better to be dead. Just more of the devaluation of life. You know, this is where the road leads when all of our life amounts to grasping for things that do not last, grasping for things that are passing and therefore not satisfying. And after enough of that, we finally come to the conclusion where we're asking these really hard questions. What is the purpose of life? What is the meaning? Is it really better off to be dead? And those are the conclusions you come to when you keep running into these roadblocks of abject disappointment and discouragement. And the person who, even under oppression, concludes that life is not worth living is ignoring a very, very important principle that the preacher keeps bringing us to in Ecclesiastes. There is a God who comforts. Take him out of the equation. He might have a good argument about this matter of death. Thinking about this God who comforts, we really need to ask this very important question. If it's more important to be dead or better to be dead than to be alive, question, who determined, who decided that you would be born? Verse 3. Better than both is he who has never been born, has not seen evil deeds that are done under the sun. You see, the debate about who has authority over birth is not something new. Solomon was debating that. So would he suggest that life is so evil, it's better to keep children from being born than be born into evil times, evil deeds, times of oppression? Is that what he's saying? Well, wait, stop and think about this for a minute. This might be a strange question. Why? You know, your life's not this bad. Just try to imagine life that's bad, okay? We all have it made. But try to imagine life that is bad. In that circumstance, question, why did you decide to be born? What were you thinking? We don't have that choice. That's not our decision, is it? why is it not my decision? Well, you know, I wasn't in control of the circumstances. I didn't get into control until I was 6 months old. I've been in control ever since. You know, that's kind of what we think, right? I wasn't in control. I had no choice. And someone at this point is going to argue, now hold on, preacher. If you're saying that God's in control of birth, that's not consistent. Because we know very clearly that there are literally millions of abortions. And we know there's been over 55 million children killed. Where was God? Is He in control? Are babies living souls? Well, absolutely. Does God allow living souls to be murdered by other living souls? Have you watched the news lately? It happens in Greenville, I guess, every night, according to the news. 3 or 4 times a night in Chicago. Does God hold those who murder responsible? Well, obviously. What did Jesus say to Judas? Well, He said to the disciples, but you know He was pointing at Judas. The Son of Man goes as it was written of Him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would be better for him not to have been born. Yeah, God holds murderers accountable, and it's very serious. That wicked people murder babies does not imply at all that God doesn't care. He does care. And there is justice. And so here, it almost looks like Solomon just kind of forgot for a moment who's in charge. Who is in control of such matters? In his discouragement, Solomon's looking at all the oppression that goes on. He's wondering, who is there to bring comfort to those who are oppressed? And then he said, wow, you know, maybe it's better not even to be born. He sounds like Job, who in his distress and frustration said, let the day perish on which I was born, the night in which they said a man is conceived. You know, Solomon and Job are sounding like Jeremiah. You know, the preacher. The whole church was against him. Jeremiah 20, verse 15. Cursed be the man who brought the news to my father. A son is born to you, making him very glad. Verse 18. Why did I come out from the womb to see toil and sorrow and spend my days in shame? All of these people temporarily forgot. There's a God who's the God of all comfort. He's just and He's compassionate. Did the preacher Koheleth here forget his own previous conclusion? I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter, for every work. In the next chapter, he's going to conclude that God is going to bring oppression into account. He is going to call the oppressors into account. Chapter 5, verse 8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor, the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter, for the high official is watched by a higher, and yet there's higher ones even over them. He's pointing all the way to God. See, these guys aren't getting away with anything. Yeah, they're oppressing the poor. Yeah, they're oppressing the less powerful, but God's in charge, and He's our God, and we're His people. Paul reminded us, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies, God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves have been comforted by God. Our God is still in control. Yes, there's oppression. Who is to comfort the oppressed? God. Because He's compassionate. And He's powerful enough. And if He's powerful enough to offer comfort to those who struggle, we really have to ask this question. What about His people? If God's the God of comfort and justice and compassion, shouldn't His people be the same way? What did Jesus teach? Matthew 25, verse 34, the king will say to those on his right, come you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave drink. I was a stranger, you welcomed me. I was naked, you clothed me. I was sick, you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. And the righteous are going to say to him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you and thirsty and give you a drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. Now that sounds like a pretty good connection, right? So who are you comforting? Who's oppressed? Who's discouraged? Are you God's people? Are you God's children? Do we have any kind of opportunity? So, well, yeah, you know, I'm God's child and I'm religious, but I don't do stuff like that. Then you need for me to introduce you to James. He wrote in chapter 1, verse 27, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, visit the orphans and the widows in their affliction, keep yourself unspotted from the world. All kinds of opportunities for us, the children of the God of all comfort, to comfort them. Well, oppression's surely evidence that life is vain. So let's just go be alone. Better to be alone than be in the rat race, right? Yeah. Well, why even try to get involved? In fact, why go to work? Because we all learn eventually that competition drives industry, right? I mean, people do what they do. People strive. People try to be successful simply out of envy. According to Solomon, verse 4, I saw that all the toil and all the skill and work comes from a man's envy of his neighbor. Now, is it like that in your world? Well, try to imagine this. Try to imagine what would happen to your world if somehow miraculously all envy, jealousy, greed, and covetousness just suddenly disappeared. I wouldn't be too surprised. We'd say, man, what a boring life. You know, what do we do for fun? What do you mean? What's Solomon saying here? Envy drives life. Or we could use the word jealousy, or we could use the word covetous. I'm just going to go ahead and tell you. I think about this sometimes, and I know I shouldn't, and this is very discouraging. There'd be no sports. I mean, who's going to strive for the championship this year? There's no envy. There's no covetousness. There's no. Okay, forget I even said that. All right? Well, let's talk about the real stuff. You know, there's not going to be any more murder, no more theft, no more kidnapping, no more rape, no more adultery, envy, covetous, jealousy, all gone. No more presidential debates. Or if there were debates, they would certainly change the format so that the presidential candidates would actually talk about what they want to do, not what the other person didn't do. And most news organizations and talk shows would just go off the air. But the real question is this: how would your life change if there was no envy driving matters of your life? How would the application of your toil and your skill change if you're not driven by vices? So Solomon concludes, you know, this is life. People strive out of envy, and man, the results are so empty. Last part of verse 4, this also is vanity and striving after the wind. And we spend our lives trying to outdo the competitor. More than that. We spend our lives trying to outdo what we did last year. Have any of you ever been in sales? I mean, that's what you have to do. You have to have more than you had last year. It doesn't matter how many you had last year. You have to have more. Envy, jealousy, striving. Isn't it wonderful that you can come to church and know that that's never an issue? Folks, I just, in case you're ignorant on this or just naive maybe, there's intense pressure on pastors and churches to do what the other guy's doing. Why would I want to do that? Well, because he has 800. headaches. Why would we do that? Envy. I kind of like Solomon's other conclusion better. A tranquil heart gives life to the flesh. Tranquility is a wonderful thing. Envy makes the bones rotten. You know, an adverse reaction to that kind of pressure and that kind of stress can be isolationism. And that's akin to self-destruction, verse 5. The fool folds his hands, he eats his own flesh. What? Yeah, an adverse reaction to the rat race is to become self-absorbed. And someone who becomes self-absorbed is a person who decides the best way to escape the rat race and all the trial and all the stress just don't work. Okay? That's an easy solution. And Solomon said, no, you can't come to that conclusion because that is self-destructive. It is literally, the word he uses is self-cannibalism. He eats his own flesh. How does that happen? Well, in another place he said, this is what happens. You decide you don't want to work. You're tired of the rat race. You get discouraged. Poverty. Proverbs 6, verse 10, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Poverty will come upon you like a robber, want like an armed man. And now what Solomon tells us is this. When we pull ourselves back and say, we don't want to work anymore, we don't want to do what God ordained, and we're not going to find God in our work, he said, you're going to do damage to yourself physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Because God created us to achieve. Now, this is not my conclusion. This is the conclusion of researchers and sociologists. That is a common characteristic among Generation Z. We also call them millennials. Now, I've got good news for you. Every time I mention the word millennial to a young person in our church in private conversation, I have wonderful news. 100% of them say, I'm not a millennial. I'm so glad to hear that. Even if they're millennial age, they're not of that character. But a lot of those people, those younger people wonder, you know, why should I go to work if I don't have to? And if you listen to the socialists, they don't have to because they're going to get paid for not working. How? Well, you, the taxpayer, are going to pay them a guaranteed salary. And it's not much. You know, it's kind of a paltry sum, and they're certainly never, ever going to buy a house on what we give them as taxpayers. But then again, what's mom and dad going to do with their house? Somebody better live in it so I don't have to work. I'll just live in mom and dad's house. And Solomon says, you're doing yourself great harm if you come to that conclusion. Removing yourself from the workforce is not the solution to the problem of the rat race. But at the same time, we also know from our own experience that quietness can be therapeutic. And Solomon came to the same conclusion. Verse 6, better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil striving after wind. Now, he draws a really neat contrast here. Because what he was talking about, the rat race and how we're driven by envy, and grabbing and grasping. In fact, all of his arguments up to this point, everything he's been grasping after and finding that it's useless, it's like somebody grabbing with both hands. That's the American dream. You have both hands full of passing stuff and you want more. And that's the picture that he draws for us. And he says, you know, the ideal is not grasping with both hands, but one handful of quietness, tranquility, confidence, contentment. How in the world can you possibly get that? Periodically, remove yourself from the rat race. Open up both of your hands. Let the stuff you think is so important go, and just go spend time with God, who is the God of all comfort and the blessed controller of all things. And just talk to Him. And meditate. And read His promises. Because who practiced removal from the rat race to commune with God the Father better than Jesus? If we follow His example, we should be in pretty good condition. You know, that would put us in a place where we would agree with Paul, not that I'm speaking of being in need, but I've learned in whatever situation I am to be content, Philippians 4:11. 1 Timothy 6:6, there is great gain in godliness with contentment. Hebrews 13:5, keep your life free from the love of money. Be content with what you have, for he said, I will never leave you or forsake you. Balance is the key. Work diligently for God's glory. Rest in God's care. This is what Solomon found out also. Greed robs us of our relationships. He asked this really strange question. Why toil for no one? Okay, here's the problem. There's this guy who's seeking satisfaction by, he's actually denying himself pleasures in life in order to gain more and more stuff that doesn't last. Verse 7, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either a son or a brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches. So he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? So here's someone we would say is very, very disciplined. Boy, he keeps his nose to the grindstone. He works hard. He deprives himself of pleasure. I mean, this is the kind of person who would be a red-blooded American achiever. He's all about capitalism. And he works hard, and he's very, very diligent. And the question is then, wait a minute, who's benefiting from all his deprivation of his own pleasure? This guy works so hard, so long, he has no friends. He works so diligently, he's really not sure he has a family. He heard that he did, but all they do is spend his money. And even he's not going to benefit. So what do people like this do? What drives them? I think it's the joy, the pleasure of the hunt. The hunt is exciting. And once they capture whatever it is they were after, they go on to something else. What an unhappy business, Solomon says. Verse 8, this also is vanity and an unhappy business. Focusing on pleasure, satisfaction for yourself, you're just going to end up at this brick wall. Unpleasant. Douglas Sean O'Donnell wrote it like this. He said, don't be selfish, a greedy workaholic, or you will find your work worthless and yourself all alone, even at your own funeral. Order your flowers now. No one else will. That's kind of morbid. That's the brick wall you run into. A selfish, stingy workaholic, probably pictured best by Charles Dickens' Ebenezer Scrooge. In the end, you find yourself all alone and unable to take all your stuff with you because you can't take it with you. And isolationism is not profitable. Far better to have help. Why? That's the way God created us. Verse 9 through verse 12, he said, you are to have relationships. They're beneficial. Far better, he says in verse 9, two are better than one. Practical ramifications. Notice how he lists these off, kind of like very quick order. Verse 9, last part of verse 9, because they have good reward for the toil, many hands make light work. You've heard that before. You're about to practice it here in a few minutes when we tear down the auditorium, set up tables. It's good to have help. Because when you fall down, somebody can pick you up. Verse 10, if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. Woe to the person who's alone when he falls. You know, if you don't have one of those little red buttons to push, help, I've fallen, I can't get up. That was before Solomon's, or after Solomon's time. It's good to have somebody there who can help you. Someone to provide warmth. Reverse 11, carefully. Again, I say, if two lie together, they will keep warm. How can one keep warm alone? Sounds a little creepy, right? Obviously, Solomon's culture wasn't like our culture. I mean, you kind of get the picture here. I don't believe I'd do that. You want to freeze? Yeah. Cultures are different. Even today, even in the Middle East, I mean, it's not unusual in the Middle East to see men holding hands with men. They don't think anything weird about it. You can go to some Eastern European churches and you will be greeted with a kiss by a man, sometimes on the lips, even though you're a man. Cultures are just different. That was Solomon's culture. Two are better than one because The other one can provide protection. Verse 12, though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Look at this progression just in chapter 4. Look what Solomon's done here. Back in chapter 4, verse 2 and verse 3, what did he say? Better not to be born, better to be dead. Zero is better than one. That's what his conclusion was. Come to verse 6. Well, it's all right to be alone. It's all right to be an isolationist. Well, one is better than zero, even if you are all by yourself. Verse 9, he specifically says, two are better than one. He's not done yet. Look at the last phrase, verse 12. A threefold cord is not easily broken. Three is better than two. Isn't that neat, the way he just progresses to this relational situation we have in all of life? Now, I'd be remiss. I'm going to do this very quickly, make application to the church. It's always good to have help. In fact, God planned it this way. We are supposed to depend on each other, not be alone. 1 Corinthians 12:14, the body does not consist of one member but many. Verse 21, same chapter, the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you, nor again to the feet, the head to the feet, I have no need of you. Hebrews 10, verse 24, verse 25, let us consider how to stir each other up to love and to good work, not neglecting the meeting together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. Isolationism and church are contradictory terms. We are relational people. God intended for us to be relational. You know, that being true, it'd be almost unnecessary for us to ever say, folks, we ought to be friendly. Well, that's what relationships is about. That's how God created us. We depend on each other because we are relationships. That's what the church is. Last, he also concluded that isolation comes even at the top. Look at this neat story. This is your typical good old American rags to riches story. You have this old foolish king in verse 13. Better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to take advice. I get the idea that possibly, maybe Solomon's looking in the mirror when he writes this, and he's the old foolish king. Because as he became older, he refused to take advice. And frankly, that's not an unusual characteristic as we grow older, isn't it? I mean, what can a young whippersnapper possibly teach an old fellow like me? The answer to that is a lot. Boy, you just don't know how tempted I am to go ahead and meddle, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to get back to the sermon. When a king cannot be taught any longer, it's time for him to step down. Get out of the way. Solomon said so. Well, you have this other king. It's the poor, wise, young king, verse 14. Better the poor, wise youth, verse 13. For he went from prison, verse 14, to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been very poor. He'd been poor, born poor. Classic American story, rags to riches, Charles Dickens. You know, it sounds like Joseph. But now here's the problem. You have the old, stubborn king who will not listen. What happens to him? He steps down and he's forgotten. You have the young, wise king. Though he was born in poverty, he achieves. And now he has a lot of people following him. But he goes to the same end. Here's the young king who leads many, according to verse 15. I saw all the living who move under the sun, along with the youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people of whom he led. I mean, here's the young king took the old king's place. All the citizens, all the subjects, all the people, his admirers, they're countless. It's the changing of the guard. It happens all the time. It's an unavoidable part of life. And leaders get old, it doesn't matter whether it's in the government or in the church or in the school, anywhere, business. Leaders get older and they move on and the younger come along and they take their place and we call it the changing of the guard. What is to become of the new hero, the new icon in the changing of the guard? Well, he follows the same path as the old king. Verse 16, yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and striving after the wind. Eventually, the young king goes the same direction as the old king, and they die. And guess what? In two generations, nobody remembers who he was. No wonder Solomon says, vanity of vanities. In fact, all the way back in chapter 1, verse 11, he said, there's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of latter things, yet to be among those who come after. Such is life without God. If all you're hoping is that somehow you can leave a legacy, my friend, I'm just going to tell you, your legacy is going to be forgotten. And nobody will remember. Two generations from now, they'll say, who? And if all of our focus is simply on the oppression that we see in the world, we're just going to be frustrated because we cannot possibly fix it all. And if we're driven by greed to compete and to somehow achieve and to gain stuff in the rat race, we are going to be absolutely frustrated because none of that is going to be satisfying. You have to keep replacing it. And if we hibernate away like so many hermits, we self-cannibalize. What do? We do what God created us to do. Enjoy fellowship with him. Focus on him. Know him. Know his commandments. Keep his commandments. Bring glory to him. That's his will for us. That's his plan. That's his desire. Now, in that process, you're going to do all of these things and all this stuff that life is about. But the focus has to be God. He has to be our point of identification. If we are identified by anything else in life, it will be a lesser identification, and we are going to be frustrated, and we're going to come to the end and say, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. God. He's our focus. And in him, we are confident. In him, we have peace. In him, we have tranquility. And that makes for a much better life.